It's almost over. Our journey through the what we call the Old Testament is almost done. We've been going through the Old Testament or the Old Covenant or the Hebrew scriptures for about a year and 9 months now. And we're getting towards the back end of that journey. We have three stories to tell, counting today. Today and two more stories after today. And we will be finished with this journey and getting ready for what's new, which is the New Testament. But today, we are still wrapping up for just a couple more weeks here, the Old Testament narrative. And we have seen, remember, the Old Testament is the story of a nation. It's the story of a couple, Abraham and Sarah, starting as a couple, they became a family, became a large group, ended up slaves in Egypt, ended up growing in number while in slavery, were brought out of slavery, grew even more, became a nation, made it to their ancestral land of promise. They filled it. They became a kingdom eventually. The kingdom was divided into the northern and southern kingdoms. The northern kingdom was carried off into captivity. About 100, 150 years later, the southern kingdom fell with Jerusalem, and the Babylonians took them over. And we saw it when that happened, that Jeremiah the prophet said to the people in the south, you're going to go into captivity, but God's going to bring you back about 70 years later and let you rebuild the city here. Well, that's where we are today. Our last three stories, and we're done with this run. And we'll get towards the New Testament in a few weeks after that. So we're almost done with the old. But today, we're going to see the post-captivity. And it begins in the book of Ezra. Well, actually, it's interesting. The end of the book of 2 Chronicles and the beginning of the book of Ezra are the exact same words, the exact same few verses. If you didn't know that, when you read those two, they're identical. So we'll read from Ezra chapter 1. We're going to be in Ezra today, just so as you know. Ezra 1 verse 1 says, in the first year of King Cyrus of Persia, that's the new king who became empowered after Babylon fell, he had a co-regent for a little while named Darius the Mede. Darius the Mede reigned over the former province of Babylon. That's where Daniel's story with the lion's den took place, with Darius the Mede. He was co-regent with Cyrus. Cyrus is the main guy because the Persian Empire has arrived in full force. And in the first year of King Cyrus, the Lord fulfilled the prophecy he had given through Jeremiah. He stirred the heart of Cyrus to put this proclamation in writing and send it throughout his kingdom. This is what King Cyrus of Persia says. The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth. He has appointed me to build a temple at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Now, a little bit about this. Those verses are spoken from the Jewish perspective. The truth is that Cyrus was doing this not just for the Jewish people, but for all the people who had been displaced by the Babylonian takeover. Remember that before Persia became the world power of that region at the time, there was Babylon, and before them was Assyria. And those two kingdoms had a tendency to conquer a nation, to haul the people out of their homeland and relocate them somewhere else and give their former land to other people as land grants or favors or whatever, and shuffle the deck, so to speak, to control people. And Babylon did that, not do that as much as Assyria, but they did do that sometimes. They did it with Jerusalem and a few others. And so when Cyrus and Persia, when Persia became the world power, they said, let's take a different approach. Let's let people go back to their ancestral lands. Now, in doing this, some of the people weren't even born in their ancestral lands. By this point, they were born in these new locations, but let's send them home. That'll mean something to them from their roots. And let's let them go back and let's allow them to rebuild. Let's let them rebuild what's important to them, their houses of worship. And if they go back and do that, maybe they'll feel that we are for them. And Cyrus is thinking, maybe we can rule them with more favor and with less revolts, basically, right? Because people will be happier if we encourage them in their home countries. So he's going to let them return, and that includes the Jerusalem. So this verse is written from the Jewish perspective, where they said, I'm letting the Jews go back to Jerusalem and rebuild in Judah, rebuild their temple. He continues in verse 3, any of you who are his people may go to Jerusalem and Judah to rebuild this temple of the Lord, the God of Israel, who lives in Jerusalem, and may your God be with you. Interesting that, notice he says the God who lives in Jerusalem. Just a little thought about that. The belief system of Persia was a little different than Babylon. Babylon believed, they worshipped Marduk, their their idol that they created that they believed gave them powers. And they believed that was their deity. And they believed, and a lot, like a lot of the world believed back then, that there were different deities in different places that were stronger in different areas than the other. Some were stronger in this region, others in that region. Some in this terrain, others in that terrain. But Marduk was obviously more powerful than them because they could go into those other terrains and conquer those nations, so Marduk was supreme. Well, the Persians had a bigger view of what God might be. They believed that there was a supreme being over all, and that all these other, there were other regional gods and deities, but these other gods and deities were strong in their area, but they were all downstream flows of the same ultimate supreme being over all. And so the Jewish people could find some similar ground there because they believed in monotheism, that there's one God, creator of all. There were some differences. They didn't believe there was little lesser gods elsewhere. They just believed there was a supreme monotheistic God. And Persia thought there was a supreme being with many sub-deities elsewhere. So there was some room to find compatibility for those who were trying to be progressive and get along. And there was room to fight for those who wanted to draw lines in the sand. But this is how it was working. And so Cyrus says, go back to Jerusalem, and in your case, the God who lives in Jerusalem, in my view, build a temple for him. And basically, pray for me, the king, and be happy that I'm letting you do this, and so you'll let me rule over you without too much drama. And may your God be with you. Now, it took a few years for this to happen. This was like 66 years after the destruction of Jerusalem. And some people went back right away. Others, it took them years or decades to go back. A lot of them had never been to Jerusalem. Many people at this point had been born and raised families and beyond in the land of their captivity. So Jerusalem and Judah was just a story of their past heritage. There were some older people who were still alive who remember being young when the whole thing went down. But most people are going back to a place they've never been, and some not for a long time. But they have built wealth where they were because Jeremiah the prophet had told them, settle down where you're in captivity. Make it work there. And they've made it work. They've built wealth and prosperity. So they're going to bring their stuff back to their old ancestral land to Jerusalem. And other people, by the king's request, gave them money and said, here, let's help you. Please go, you know, go back home. And so then as they went back home to Jerusalem, they had wealth to some measure. And that's not all. King Cyrus took all the royal artifacts that were in the temple of Jerusalem that Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon captured when he tore down Jerusalem and the temple. Cyrus demanded that Darius the Mede release all those artifacts and send them with the Jews so they can re-put them in their temple once it was finished being built. He wanted to honor their practices. Well, I got to skip a lot of story today to cover all of Ezra in one day, but we do want to finish up the Old Testament in a couple weeks here. So I'm going to cover a lot of ground and skip a lot of story. But I want you to know two names in this part of the story. They are Zerubbabel and Jeshua, or sometimes it's translated Joshua in other spots in these writings. And so they are basically they're the civic and religious leaders of that day. Back in Jerusalem, returning to Jerusalem. Zerubbabel was a down descendant of King David, part of the Davidic line, which was very important to the people of Jerusalem. Jeshua was part of the priestly heritage and the line there. So these were important leaders in this government that was always kind of a mixture of faith and politics in those days. And all the people began to gather and rebuild. Now, when I say they began to gather and rebuild, nobody in their lifetime was going to rebuild Jerusalem. Jerusalem was a vast city, a fortress city at one time that was completely destroyed by the Babylon because it took of the stubborn refusal to cooperate with Babylon. They just decimated it. And it has been abandoned for decades now, for decades. Think about this with me. Have you ever been by a town, have you ever driven to a town that's abandoned or at least has shrunk down from its former days? Like it used to be full of business, but maybe some businesses shut up, some industries went away. And if you've ever been by a town like that where all the businesses in town are boarded up, the windows are got plywood because the glass has been broken, there's graffiti, and you wonder, what would it take to revitalize this town? Well, that would be Jerusalem, except for far, far worse. It was not just abandoned, it was destroyed. And the group that's coming back cannot take that massive city and rebuild it in their lifetime. But what they can do is they can come around the temple area and start there. so they can rebuild the temple eventually. And they can maybe make the immediate land around it better. You got to start somewhere, don't you? So that's where they focus on. Well, unfortunately, they have opposition. And here's why. This is neither here nor there, unless you are a nerd like some of us are. But up north, others of the Jewish people had already returned from captivity from when the northern kingdom was captured. They've already been back. There were already Jews in what used to be Israel, that's now the land of Samaria. And they've already built a new temple in Samaria, in Mount Gerizim. So they don't think there's a reason to build another one in Jerusalem unless you're fighting for the old political north versus south divide, which is a political fight. So they opposed a new temple being rebuilt in Jerusalem. There are people around them who weren't even Jewish who had come there and kind of mingled with the Jews that were there and interworked and married, and they became Yahweh followers or Yahwists, and they didn't see the reason for a new temple being built or Jerusalem being rebuilt. That was a political divide. And so they opposed these returning people. And here's what's interesting. In verse number 3, it says, even though the people were afraid of the local residents, they rebuilt the altar at its old site. They began to sacrifice burnt offerings at the altar of the Lord each morning and evening. So as they come back and begin to rebuild, they said, we got to get a temple here again, but let's start with an altar. And some people won't like that, and they're going to oppose our work, but let's just get started. The opposition did not stop them. Their fear did not stop them. And they got busy. They hired workers. They bought materials. They bartered for materials. They did as much as they could. They had every man 20 years of age and older working on the job. Well, eventually, they began to make progress on the temple. When you build a new building or you build a house, what's the first thing you do first? You build the foundation, right? And that might take a long time, right? Because if the foundation's wrong, the whole structure's going to have problems. You got to get the foundation right. It might take a while, but it's so important. And they laid the foundation of the temple, and probably the foundation of the temple was about the same specifications as the former temple proper. However, in Solomon's day, there was a lot of external outbuildings and additions to it. They probably couldn't do everything they used to do, but they built the foundation of the temple itself to rebuild the temple. They got that laid, it's all nice. And when the foundation was finished, they paused from their work to appreciate what they've accomplished. Sort of a late ribbon-cutting ceremony. Here's the foundation, here's the footprint of what's gonna be. Let's celebrate. In verse 11, it says that with praise and thanks, they sang this song to the Lord. He is so good. His faithful love for Israel endures forever. Then all the people gave a great shout, praising the Lord, because the foundation of the Lord's temple had been laid. Can you picture the excitement in Jerusalem? They're back. Some of them for the first time, or for the first time in decades. They've heard stories. They come back to their home city, and it's in shambles, and they're sad to see that. But now they've cleared off an area around the temple, and they've relaid the foundation. They're going to build again. They're so excited. They're praising. They're shouting for joy. Everyone's happy. Well, not everyone is happy. Look at verse 12. But many of the older priests, Levites, and other leaders who had seen the first temple wept aloud when they saw the new temple's foundation. Why? They wept when they saw the new temple's foundation because they had seen the old one. And apparently they felt, as, and we're going to see this in a moment, that they don't think it was what it used to be. Well, they remember the old one being. And they see this new one and they're weeping at the sight of the new foundation. Instead of being excited. It says the others, however, were shouting for joy because, hey, we're making progress. We got a new temple coming on. Woo, let's go. But these other ones who are older and were remembering the past are weeping. And they weren't just like silently sad and just pushing through. They were carrying on about it. It says in the next part of the verse, in verse number 13, the joyful shouting and the weeping mingled together in a loud noise that could be heard far in the distance. People would be like, I hear it. What is that? People are celebrating? No, I think people are weeping. I think it's both. It's mingling together. It's carrying over each other. And this goes on. Now, why? Because to the people who were old enough to have been there when they were young, they're like, it ain't what it used to be. It ain't what it used to be. They're lamenting. The good old days. Now, I'm going to step away from the story. This is our main point today. I'm I'm gonna step away from the story to take you back in to how I grew. So I grew up in a very fundamentalist Christian home, and not just a home, but a movement, a church, a religious movement. And that's how I was raised. That's how I first pastored, because that's what I knew. And I always heard this text preached from when I was growing up in church. I'd hear this text preached from with that phrase in the translation that we would use, that the old men wept while the young men rejoiced. The old men wept while the young men rejoiced. The old men wept because, you know, they remember how great it used to be, and it wasn't the same anymore. And they knew what was missing and how far they had come and how far down they've come, and they are sad by it, but the young men were happy because they didn't know any better. And the old men were heralded as the people who remember the good old days. And I would hear that preached by communicators who were using it. And this happens today. I've seen it in today's culture. It's not just from my background. People who would want to lament, use this as a jumping off point to lament what's wrong with society, what's wrong with everything. They say, oh, I'll tell you what. The church ain't what it used to be in the old days of the great revivals of the past. I remember how God used to work and the great leaders of the past and voices of the past, and it ain't what she used to be. You people are so excited today. You don't know what you've missed. I do. The old men wept while the young men rejoiced. Or they would say, you know, I remember America when she was great, you know, and it ain't what it used to be. And I'll tell you, I remember you're excited because you don't know what's come to pass. And it was always a message. It was kind of like just a chance for someone to vent. As we get older, it's so easy to get in a space where we get older and we like don't like change. We don't like things that are different and we're sentimental, and you know, so we become like the old man yelling at the clouds or yelling at the kids, get off my lawn, you know. And we get crotchety because we're like, it ain't what it used to be. And that's so easy. And I heard messages given through the years, and still today, of people who are lamenting America or lamenting church or lamenting anything about how things ain't like they used to be. And here's the problem with that. That's the way I heard the text taught when I was young. It took me a number of years of being an adult and ministering before I realized that's not the point of the story. That's not what's being done here. Like, they're not. In fact, we're going to see a biblical clarity that is not how this story should be interpreted. The problem was that these folks who have been around were living in a past that was sugar-coated in their minds and discouraging the work going forward with that mindset. Now, why were they living in the past? Because they were looking at it through what I call the rose-colored glasses of sentimentality. Being sentimental can be very rose-colored in its appearance. You know, a good Bible example of that? Reminds me of the Jewish people when they came out of slavery in Egypt. They're like in slavery. God, get us out of slavery. Please, it's terrible. Get us out of here. Then God brings them out. They're wandering for years in the wilderness as nomadic people with the same old boring food. And they begin to say, oh, I wish I was back in Egypt. Back in the good old days when we had all the good food, life was so good. You're like, really? Life was so good that you hated it. You're remembering with fondness something in the past that you hated at the time. It's like we're never content with what we have now. It's always a different time. So sentimentality is a funny thing. And part of the problem, and we're going to see this, and I'm going to make this very clear, is they're misremembering the former temple. And I want to make that clear in two ways. For one, they remember when most of them who are alive still were very young when they left Jerusalem decades earlier. You ever get older, and you get older and you go back and see something that used to seem different when you were little? So here's my personal story. When I was from the age of 3 or 4 until I was about 10 or 11, we lived in Hammond, Indiana, off the corner, a couple blocks inward from Calumet Avenue and 165th, for those who care. Anyhow, because I know people, some of you are from that area. We lived a couple blocks off of that space in a little neighborhood. And I grew up there for several years. Then after 5th grade, we moved to Michigan. And sometime later in life, I came back, got married, and I'm taking my bride in a car ride. We're going to get some treats, you know, get something to drink, and take a little drive to my old neighbor. I'm going to show her the old stomping grounds where I grew up. So we drive through our old neighborhood. I'm like, yeah, there's the house right there. And as I drove past the house, I was shocked. Someone had shrunk my old house. It was shocking. Like that, I remember I ran through that house and I played in those rooms and it was so awesome. And in my yard, I played in that big old yard. Someone took a shrink gun and shrunk my old house. It was wrong. Now, I know that's not what happened, and you know what happens. When you're little, everything seems bigger. When you get older, you look back and say, huh, that seemed bigger when I was young. And there's a whole conversation there, isn't there? Probably one of those reminders of us about how we should be careful what we say in front of our little ones, because what might be venting to us about things we are upset about might be bigger to them at their age and stick with them in a heavier way. But that's another sermon. But anyhow, things seem bigger when you're young. And so they're like, oh, the old temple. I remember the old temple. Ain't like it used to be. Can I be honest with you? Everyone alive in this story did not see the temple in its glory. In its glory was when Solomon built it. It was not one generation after Solomon before it was already getting shredded by Rehoboam, having to pay off foreign kings to not beat them up. For king after king after king since Solomon built that thing, it had been decimated, fallen in disrepair, had to be repaired by kings who cared, stripped of its glory by opposing. By the time anyone in the story was alive, if they were alive, they were alive during Zedekiah, the king's reign, and that temple was bare bones what it used to be. So those glory days weren't all that. But again, sentimentality and the rose-colored glasses. They're like, oh, I'll tell you what, it ain't what it used to be, the good old days. And the problem was they were discouraging the workers who were trying to build. In fact, here's what's going to happen. In the next part of the story, they're going to stop building because there's opposition. There's always been opposition, but they're going to stop building for a while. And here's the thing. The people who were upset that the new one didn't remind them of how great it used to be, they weren't just internalizing that quietly, saying, oh, I kind of missed the old days. Oh, well. They were wailing about it. They were like, we're upset. And the people were rejoicing, and they're going to match your happy. I'm going to be as upset as you are happy until you know that I know it ain't like it used to be. I'm going to drive the point home to every bit of your intensity until everyone is clear that it ain't as good as it used to be nowadays. And they discourage the people. And we're going to see that in just a moment here. The people stopped working. They just stopped. If you read Ezra 4, I'm going to say something nerdy, but just for those who care. Ezra 4 is really wacky. The timeline, the kings that are mentioned, just makes no sense historically. But the book is compiled, is written, and it's compiled, and it's kind of assembled centuries later. And there's an explanation that people have parsed it out. It doesn't matter. If you see me after church, we can nerd out about Ezra 4 if reading it confuses anyone here. But the bottom line is, through the story, they had outside opposition telling them to stop building. Now, they were opposed since they got there, but they built anyhow despite their fear. Now they're opposed, and now they're afraid again, and this time they stop building. And it says in verse 24 of chapter 4, so the work on the temple of God in Jerusalem stopped and remained at a standstill until the second year of the reign of King Darius of Persia, not to be confused with Darius the Mede. Darius was a title for kings kind of like Herod or Pharaoh or Caesar. Many people held the same title. Darius of Persia is not Darius the Mede that Daniel knew. This is Darius the First, who came later, which is weird, but he's the king of Persia. And in his reign, they're going to start rebuilding again. But here's the bottom line. Nothing will have changed. The opposition that stopped them from building before was still there, but they're going to get back to building anyway. It's not until after they begin to build before the opposition will eventually lighten up and things will happen. So here's what I read the story. I see people who came there facing outside opposition and were afraid, but they built anyway. Then I see the same people stop building because of opposition and fear. But then later, they get back to building despite the same opposition and the same fear. Why did opposition never stop them, but for a while it did? Why did their fear never stop them, but for a while in the middle it did? What was different in the middle that caused them to stop? And we're on the verge of understanding what it is. And so, let's see it together. Ezra chapter 5 and verse 1 says, at that time, the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, son of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews in Judah and Jerusalem. They prophesied in the name of the God of Israel who was over them. What is that talking about? If you were here last Sunday, we talked about the minor prophets. Remember, nerds, all that stuff? We talked about the minor prophets. And we actually read a little bit from Haggai and Zechariah. And if you remember, Haggai was the guy who said last week to all the people, hey, you all stopped building the temple, which is what you came here for, and you're instead building your own houses and properties while your house of worship is lying in shambles and unbuilt. And he said, God's not going to bless all your other work because you're concerned about the rest of your life and you're neglecting your spiritual life. Build the place of worship. Get that place built and fixed up and done right. And don't neglect that while you pursue your own agendas of life if you want God to bless. We saw that last week if you were with us. Well, Haggai wasn't done there. Haggai has something else to say in his book that I want you to see. And when we see it, you're going to realize exactly why he puts his thumb right on the pulse of the problem, of why they were facing opposition, but they built anyway at the beginning, faced opposition, but built anyway in the end. But in the middle, the opposition and fear caused them to stop. And Haggai puts his thumb on it in chapter 2. Let's read it together. Haggai 2, verse 3. He says, does anyone remember this house, this temple, in its former splendor? Me? I've been telling all these people. I've been telling these kids. Yes, I remember how good it used to be. Okay? He says, how in comparison does it look to you now? It must seem like nothing at all in your eyes. Oh, that's what I've been trying to tell them. They're all excited. I'm telling you, you shouldn't be excited. Because you don't know how good and how far we've come. The wrong direction, you know. He's like, is that how you feel? Is that how you feel? Yes, that's how I feel. He's got his thumb right on it. And then he says this, but now, says the Lord, be strong, Zerubbabel. Be strong, Jeshua, the high priest. Be strong, all you people still left in the land. And now get to work, for I am with you, says the Lord of heaven's armies. Look, I hear you. Maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong, maybe it doesn't matter. Here's the bottom line. I'm trying to do something right now. Get to work. Get to it. This is where we are right now. We have something to build. Get to work again. I love it. He says this. My spirit remains among you, just as I promised when you came out of Egypt, so do not be afraid. For this is what the Lord of heaven's army says. In just a little while, I will again shake the heavens and the earth with the oceans and the dry land. I will shake all the nations and the treasures of all the nations will be brought to this temple. I will fill this place with glory, says the Lord of heaven's armies. Here's what he's saying. Look, you can't make it all you want it to be right now. But we're just getting started. I got days ahead that you ain't seen yet. Just do what you can. See, the people trying to rebuild the temple, they didn't have the resources that Solomon did way back in the day. None of them were alive for those good old days. But back when Solomon first built the temple, he had a lot of resources. Can I reminisce with you for just a moment? When Solomon built the temple the first time, he had his father David spend decades preparing money and materials for the building of the temple. Because his father, it was a passion project. Solomon inherited that, plus taxed the nation like crazy. By the way, he had all 12 tribes of the United Kingdom at that time. He taxed them like crazy. He drafted their kids into labor. He had all the resources of the land to build that thing. And it took him 7 years with all of that once they started to finish the job. This group of people coming back from captivity, they're pretty well off for who they are, but that's all they have. And they don't have tribes of Israel and ability to tax anybody. All they have is what they have. And they're going to build something. But they can't touch what Solomon once did. And none of them, even the oldest of them, ever saw that glory anyhow. But here's the deal. God says, I'm not done yet. You just build what you have here, and I'll get there. It might take a few years. It might go beyond your life. It may take some decades down the road. But it's going to get there. I'll bring the place back to what it used to be and better. In fact, he says that in verse 8. The silver is mine, the gold is mine, says the Lord of heaven's armies. The future glory of this temple will be greater than its past glory, says the Lord of heaven's armies. And in this place, I will bring peace. I, the Lord of heaven's armies, have spoken. What is he saying? The future glory will be better than the present glory or the past glory. Here's what happens. Just a little history for us because we won't necessarily spend time here. In the centuries that follow this story today, the people of the story today will build the temple. While they're back to building it, they will get extra money comes back to them. Once they get back to work, God will start sending them more resources, which is pretty cool. Once you get back to work, God takes care of the stuff, right? But then when they finish what they can do, it still ain't all it will be. In the decades, in the center, they die, their ancestors come, they build more. In fact, it gets built better and eventually gets torn back down a little bit because they are in the middle of the, we call it the Levant, the Asia Minor area. They're in the middle of world empires from Egypt to Assyria to Babylon to Persia to Alexander the Great and the Greek Macedonian powerhouse to the Roman Empire to come. They're in the middle of like war zone central. So they'll make it better. It'll get torn down a little bit again. They'll rehab it again. It'll get beat up again. They'll rehab it again. But by the time that Jesus Christ shows up, which is where we're getting to talk about this holiday season, by the time that Jesus shows up, the temple will have been better than ever because Herod the Great will be the ruler of that region under the Roman Empire. And to make the people happy, he's going to take the temple, he's going to ordain it, he's going to make all the money, he's going to expand the courtyards and the outer yards so vast that it will no longer be known as just the temple or Solomon's temple from the old days. It'll be Herod's temple because it's so magnificent. It's a wonderful sight. Bigger, hundreds of thousands of people will be able to fit into its property to worship and celebrate the Jewish festivals. The future glory was indeed greater than the past glory, but not when the story was being told. And so the prophet is saying, guys, I know some of you have this memory of what you think was so much better in the past. And some of you don't, but you've been hearing that talk and it's discouraged you. But I'm just telling you to get to work because I'm trying to do something right now and I'm not done today. So get after it. And sure enough, let's go back to the book of Ezra. Ezra chapter 5, verse 2, it says, Zerubbabel and Jeshua responded by starting again to rebuild the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them and helped them. And here's where it gets wild. They're still opposed, they're still afraid, but they get back to building because they heard a good pep talk. And as they're building, the craziest thing happens. The governor of the province and others who did not like it said, what are you doing? They're like, we're just building. Cyrus gave us permission way back in the day. So they write letters to Darius I, the king of Persia, saying, these guys are building and you should stop them. The last king was on our side. And they said that Cyrus said they can build. What do you say? And Darius looks at the record book and says, oh, yes, they are supposed to rebuild the temple. Cyrus wants it rebuilt because he wants all the people to be happy and offer sacrifices to God and pray for the king, which is me now. So you tell them to build and you don't stop them. In fact, I'm going to order all of you around them to tax each other and give tax money to them to help them make the temple even better. And once they started building, it all started falling into place. And it says eventually in verse 14, in Ezra chapter 6, verse 14. So the Jewish elders continued their work, and they were greatly encouraged by the preaching of the prophets Haggai and Zechariah. The temple was finally finished, as has been commanded by the Lord God of Israel and decreed by Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, the kings of Persia. It was finally done. Now, maybe no one has thought this today, but just in case someone's sitting here thinking this, I want to point it out. Maybe you're sitting here saying, this is the book of Ezra, and I've not met Ezra yet. And that's because Ezra doesn't show up until the end. There are 10 chapters in Ezra. The first 6 chapters are the story that we just told. The last 4 chapters are Ezra's story, and it happens decades later. Like from the end of chapter 6 until the start of chapter 7 is like 58 years of time have passed. By the time Ezra shows up to this story, people in this story, a lot of them are dead now. The little ones have grown up and raised their own families, have grandkids now. I mean, it's been like 6 decades before Ezra shows up in chapter 7. Let's read a couple verses so that you'll meet Ezra before we're done. Ezra 7 verse 1 says, many years later, during the reign of King Artaxerxes of Persia, there was a man named Ezra. Verse 6 says, this Ezra was a scribe who was well-versed in the law of Moses, which the Lord, the God of Israel, had given to the people of Israel. He came up to Jerusalem from Babylon, and the king gave him everything he asked for because the gracious hand of the Lord his God was on him. So Ezra comes by later. He is basically working for the Persian government in a way because the king decrees that he wants them to go back to this newly built, well, recently built temple and make sure they're doing their worship the way that would please the God of that area in his mind because he didn't have the same exact views they had about God. And so he said, go back to this area and teach the people and make them pray for the king. He was all about it. And so Ezra comes back both as a basically a worker for the king of Persia, but also as a Jewish man who loved to do what he was doing. He had the dream job. And it says in the end of verse 6 that the gracious hand of the Lord his God was on him. It says the same thing in verse 9. Why was the gracious hand of the Lord his God upon him? Verse 10 answers it. This was because Ezra had determined to study and obey the law of the Lord and to teach those decrees and regulations to the people of Israel. Now, there's a mouthful right there that I'm not going to get stuck on. That's a whole message right there. It reminds me of something that Jesus does later. In fact, we'll probably talk about this idea many, many months from now when we're talking about Jesus' life later on. But what's interesting is that, like others in the Bible, Ezra stands out because he both did and taught what was right. He studied and knew the law of God, and he obeyed and followed it for himself, but he also taught it to others, and that's rare. Let me tell you something right now. There's a lot of people who teach others about what they ought to do, but they don't practice what they preach. They teach it, but they don't do it. And there are others who do the right stuff, but they just keep it in their own little bubble to themselves, you know? And so to be a person that lives it out and passes it on, well, that's kind of who Ezra was. And it's kind of neat. And we're going to stop there today because Ezra will be a contemporary of the person we're going to meet next time named Nehemiah. We have two stories to go and we'll be done. And the next story solves a huge problem that you may not have thought about. Here's the problem. They're back in Jerusalem. They've rebuilt the temple, but the city is mostly in ruins. And the city wall was torn down decades. In fact, at this point, 150 years earlier, the temple wall had been torn down by the time Ezra was around. And here he is trying to reestablish some kind of a culture in Jerusalem with no city. Cities had to have walls back then, or they were vulnerable. Who's going to fix that vulnerability? Well, Nehemiah comes in and does something absolutely amazing. He's a pretty cool leader as far as what he's able to accomplish. He's a go-getter, and it's a fun little story to tell. And we'll go there next week and then have one more after that before we're done with our journey through the Old Testament. But for today, here's what I want to say. Don't be a prisoner of the past. I know how easy it is to be sentimental about the past. And sometimes we're like the Israelites longing for Egypt. It wasn't that great, but we remember what we remember through rose-colored glasses. It's easy for us as we get older to lament things that change because we don't like change. Let's be honest. Men, maybe we're worse at it. We become crotchety old people. Not always. It's men and women. We're both equal, you know, partners in crime, right? Get crotchety about things and I ain't like it used to be. I'm getting older. I got to fight that. I don't want to be that person. Kids these days, music these days, life these days, the world these days, work ethic these days. You know what made me laugh? I said this to Anthony and I've discussed this before, and we, between services, remembering this. I remember reading, because I grew up in the 80s, 70s, 80s, 90s, whatever, you know, I grew up in the 70s and 80s, remembering how our parents would be like, oh, you can't go outside and play anymore. Like when we were kids, you'd run around and play, no one cared, but now that it's dangerous out there. Of course, now they see what people today are saying, oh, it wasn't like when we were kids. You could just go out and play and run around. You can't do that anymore because it's dangerous out there now. Well, I thought it was that way when I was a kid, because that's what I heard too. I read an article a while back ago of someone lamenting, oh, the world's so much worse than it used to be. You can't let kids go out and just play anymore. Like when I was little, we could go out and play. You can't let them do it anymore because it's so much more dangerous. It was written in the 1920s. And I realized that every single generation says the same thing. Every generation says the same thing because when we're little, we feel safe. We don't feel fine. But when we become older and parents, and then we freak out, you know, and then we're more aware of the woes of the world. Today we have social media and to help us. We're aware. And so all of a sudden, it ain't like it used to be. It probably was worse than we ever imagined it was before. We just didn't know. But I know. That's how it is. And if we're not careful, we'll get older and older and just lament the world. And we'll tell everyone who's around us, well, let me tell you, back in my day, back when church was the best days of church are behind us, the best days of America are behind us, the best days of everything are behind us. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe people have been saying that for a long time. And maybe that's just a discouragement to everybody who's trying to figure out how to go forward from here. I want to say this. Don't be a prisoner of the past. God is forward-looking. God is a forward-looking God. We've seen it over and over again, and we'll see it some more. God over and over again says something like this. He says, I'm not focused on what used to be. I'm focused on what could be. Come on now. I'm not focused on what used to be. I'm focused on what could be. What used to be is in the past. Listen, it's true in every part of our lives. It's like when we get spoken to by God's Spirit about doing better. If I'm doing something wrong in my life, God's Spirit convicts me about it. It's because he's trying to fix my present for the sake of my future. That's how God works. You know what he doesn't do? But the enemy does, he brings up our past to bring guilt and shame on things we can't change. And God's always like, I'm not focused on what used to be. I'm focused on what could be. And we've got to be forward-looking people. We can't be prisoners of the past. And I know for some of us, we're prisoners of a bad past. We're like, oh, I've had so much failure and regret. I just don't know what I can do anymore because I've got such a bad track record. Hey, that's the past, man. Let's go forward. Maybe we're prisoners of a good past. We're lamenting how we saw things before and what we don't like about today, and we're just sitting back being a discouragement to ourselves and others. Or maybe it's our good past. Let me tell you what I used to do. I was amazing, and I did great things, and let me tell you about my, I used to do all the good stuff. And I was like, congratulations, here's your trophy, unworthy. But here's the thing. And I'm like, I've got trophies of my own to celebrate if I want to get stuck on them. But here's the thing. So, if I'm not careful, if you're not careful, that will discourage you by saying, my best days are behind me. My best days are behind me. Or make us proud. Either way, we'll be complacent. And God says, I'm forward looking. I'm not focused on what used to be. I'm focused on what could be. The best is yet to come. And that's true for you. That's true for me. Because if you're still here, it means God's got a purpose for you still, man. If you're still breathing, God's got a plan. God's got something for you. What is it, the thing? And so here's a prayer. I want to give you a prayer to pray. That if you're a little stuck today, maybe with the regrets of yesterday, or maybe the glory of yesterday, or maybe just getting complacent as we get older. And when you're young today, you're like, I don't need this yet. You will. Here's a prayer to pray when you find yourself stuck. It goes like this. Lord, where do we go from here? Lord, where do we go from here? Although I know where we've been. Maybe I've been running from you for a long time. There was no we because I was out of there. But Lord, here I am. Where do we go from here? Lord, we've had some great days in the past. That's wonderful. But where do we go from here? Because there's a from here for all of us. It may look different for each of us depending on our space in life and where we are. But God's forward looking. And if we let the past discourage us, or we use the past as a tool to discourage others, because they need to know, I'll tell you something. No. Let's do what we can, and let's cheer on every good thing that God is doing. Let's encourage the hearts of those around us, even when things are different, even when things look different. Everything looks different over the last thousands of years. That's how life works. That's not a bad thing. Maybe bad to me. It's not bad. What is God going to do today? Where do we go from here? So, that's the prayer I want you to pray. So we're not prisoners of our past. And then, let's be real here. You and I will have a whole lot more of an enjoyable journey if we're looking forward with eagerness and anticipation instead of stuck somewhere in our past or someone else's past. Where do we go from here?